Case number 12-5375, Jicarilla Apache Nation Appellant v. United States Department of the Interior et al. Mr. Grove for the appellant, Ms. Newman for the appellee.
Let's wait until the courtroom is clear. All right.
May it please the court. There is not, nor has there ever been, any suggestion that Congress or the agency had any intention to create an alternate appeal process to Part 290. Nothing in the statutes, in their legislative history, regulations, or their preambles suggests such an intent. Merrick made it up by creating ambiguity where there was none. Instead, Congress's intent in PROGRAMA is perfectly clear. It was about rampant undercollection of royalties. It was about a lack of enforcement tools and about imposing meaningful penalties. It was not about giving violators a second bite at the apple. The United States suggests that the IBLA opinion is a reasonable interpretation of ambiguous regulations, but the only ambiguity here is systematically contrived. 241 provides that if you did not request a hearing on the record on a notice of noncompliance under 241, you may not contest your underlying liability for civil penalties.
Can I ask you sort of maybe a threshold question here? If we put to one side the Indian canon, let's put that to one side. Is it your argument that our deference applies here, or?
I think that there is no. The IBLA decision does not deserve deference because it's inconsistent with
But if it's our deference, the standard is it has to be plainly erroneous or plainly inconsistent with the regulation. Is that your argument?
Yes, it is.
Plainly erroneous and plainly inconsistent?
It is, Your Honor. We would contend that the IBLA...
That's different than ambiguous. That's what I'm seizing upon. You started your argument talking about ambiguity. If we're in the land of our deference, and maybe we're not, but from the land of our deference, that's not the standard. It's not just ambiguity. You have to show that that the agency's interpretation was, again, plainly erroneous or plainly inconsistent with the regulation.
Yes, Judge Griffith, we would contend that the decision doesn't deserve deference on multiple levels, but including our, that it is plainly erroneous and inconsistent with not only the intent of PROGRAMA, the underlying statute, but with the applicable regulations and with the clearly stated position of the agency, both before and after the order to perform was issued. So under the our standard, we would contend that the decision is not entitled to deference.
And how is it plainly inconsistent with the regulation? How is the IVLA's decision plainly inconsistent with the language of the regulation? Frequently when lawyers make that sort of argument, or when they say, as I had the example yesterday, this is a really simple case, it makes me feel really dumb because it doesn't seem, sometimes they don't seem simple to me. And maybe you can help me here, but how is this plainly inconsistent with the language of the regulation?
Well, starting with the statute itself, PROGRAMA, intent of Congress in enacting PROGRAMA and the clear message of Lanoe's report, which is a legislative history of
PROGRAMA. Can you get there without congressional intent? In other words, can you look at the words and say that this is clearly inconsistent?
Yes. The timing, strict imposition of time limits has been in place for 60 years under 290. Merritt had a 30-day time limit to appeal the order to perform. And the regulations state that you may not request and will not receive an extension of time for filing the notice of appeal. The decision from the IBLA would render that standard meaningless. It would leave you in an incoherent result where, based on the IBLA's decision, you could tell an oil and gas producer that if it receives an order to perform, it's free to simply ignore the order to perform, notwithstanding the emphatically stated and heretofore strictly enforced time limits. It can then wait to see if MMS issues a notice of noncompliance, and if so, according to the IBLA's decision, the producers could then appeal the order to perform at a hearing on the notice of noncompliance, just as if the time limits for appealing the order to perform had never existed.
You're looking at 290.
Pardon?
You're looking at 290.
Yes.
How does 241 fit into this analysis?
Well, 241 is strictly about the penalties that were imposed by Congress in Fogrum, not about the underlying validity of the order to perform. And the agency has stated that these are separate, that Part 290 is unrelated to the civil penalty proceeding under Part 241, that they're entirely different processes prescribed separately by statute, entirely different purposes.
Isn't what you just said consistent with the IBLA's idea that this is a separate track for relief, which is not governed by 290? Or am I misreading?
Could you repeat?
Am I misreading that, or is the IBLA saying there are two separate tracks for review here that don't govern each other?
That is what the IBLA is saying, and that's what we contend.
Isn't that consistent with what you just said about them not having anything to do with each other?
I see your point, Your Honor. The IBLA's interpretation of 241 is necessarily inconsistent with the longstanding practices with 290.
That doesn't answer the question as to whether they can be using it or not. That the two are inconsistent with each other. If, as you said, these are two totally separate things, I don't see how that renders interpretation of 241 clearly erroneous.
The use of this language, separately and entirely different, unrelated, is a two-edged sword. When I first
read... You brought
read,
it up.
Pardon?
You brought it up. It's a two-edged sword. It doesn't get us very far to say it's a two-edged sword. That's why I asked you about it.
Well, it's... You can't have this result if... Even though they're completely separate, even though they have entirely different purposes, you can't have a result that would render the 290 appeal meaningless. I mean, this court has stated that it will not adopt an interpretation of a statute or regulation when such an interpretation would render that law meaningless or lead to absurd results. And this is our concern, that if the IBLA's decision is allowed to stand, then the 290 process becomes meaningless. It's an absurd result. The court has also said that agencies are free to change the course of, as their expertise and experience may suggest or require, but when they do so, they must provide a reasoned analysis indicating that prior policies and standards are being deliberately changed.
When did they render a prior decision that this is a change?
Well, that's the problem. They didn't. They apparently
well,
were not even...
Well, that's irrelevant then. The holding we've had in the past that an agency can't change by practice without explaining it is not relevant.
There is a change in the prior practices because now...
Their prior practice? IBLA's prior practice?
Yes. In the past, if you didn't appeal a 290 order to perform under 290 within 30 days, then that time limit was strictly enforced. said you may not even request an extension, that one won't be granted. Now, in the aftermath of the IPLH decision.
Were there any instances where a 241 action was brought where they said, no, you can't bring that because of 290? I mean, that's the more relevant inquiry, isn't it?
Could you repeat, Judge?
Were there any instances in which a 241 process was brought and the response of the IBLA was, no, you can't bring that because you haven't exhausted under 290?
Well, actually, that's one of the concerns here, is that this decision from the IBLA is anomalous.
No, but are there any prior IBLA decisions which refused to allow someone to pursue 241?
No one else except Merit has attempted to use this route.
No, I was just seizing on your argument that there was a change here. And the way I understand change to mean would be is if previously the IBLA had said you cannot bring a 241 action under these circumstances, but now you can.
Well, the position of the agency in the past has been that you cannot proceed with an appeal of an order to perform under 290 unless you do it within 30 days.
I understand that. But the issue here is how that is changed, if at all, by the existence of the 241 procedure. That's the question.
Well, if 241 is as the IBLA has described it in this opinion, then it renders the 60 years of 290 practice and policy meaningless.
You clearly can't proceed on a 290 appeal. That's over and done.
Right.
But you might be able to proceed with 241. And I'm certain we'll hear from government about whether that is in any significant way
different. It would make no sense to allow an oil and gas producer to proceed under 241 if it's already been timed out under 290. And that the fact that they're different is, in one case, 241 is about the penalties. It's an opportunity to contest the penalties that's imposed for not complying with the order to perform. 290 is about the underlying order to perform. It's your opportunity to appeal that order about the substance, which Merit has endeavored to raise at a hearing that's supposed to be strictly about penalties.
What do you do with the language in 241 about the underlying liability for civil penalties?
241 states, if you did not request a hearing on the record on the notice of noncompliance, you may not contest your underlying liability for civil penalties. And the problem
that if you did, I mean, the negative pregnant at least there is that if you did contest, then you could raise the underlying liability.
The underlying liability doesn't stand alone. It's an underlying liability for civil penalties. And this is where there's been a methodical omission of that latter portion.
Now, that may be your interpretation of that, but it takes us back to Judge Griffith's question about our standard of review. And our standard of review, don't we defer to what the IBLA has said about that?
You defer to the IBLA unless its decision leads to an absurd result, or unless it's changing. It didn't deliberately change. It more casually ignored.
That takes us back to the change question. You still haven't given us the opinion from which it's changing here. When did it have the 290 and the 241 conflict that it reached a different result than it did in this case?
We haven't had this except in Merit.
So we don't have a change, do we? We have a beginning, not a change, right?
But we have a beginning that's totally inconsistent with the stated position of the agency. And not only that,
what's the stated position of the agency with reference to that? What
is
it changing from? If you're going to go on the change of jurisprudence, you have to tell us what A was before they got to B. So what is the prior stated position? Give us a citation and a quotation of the prior stated position from which they're changing.
I think the problem is that the IBLA was not even aware of the unintended consequences of its decision.
I don't think that's an answer to my question.
Could you rephrase your question, Judge St. Helen?
You are arguing that there is an unexplained change. Now, if there's an unexplained change, then there has to be something that IBLA is changing from. Now, you told me it was changing from its prior stated position, but I don't know of any prior stated position reflecting upon the interaction between 1090 and 241 on this question. Do you?
I don't. And, in fact, counsel for
Merit... So they're not changing from a prior stated position, then?
Isn't the prior stated position the policy on 290, its strict time limits?
No, I don't think
and,
so.
And what's covered by
290? The question here is how that interplays with the 241 action. And I don't find in the briefs any prior stated position from which this is a change.
It's a new interpretation of 241 that's entirely different than all the prior history. It's inconsistent with Congress's intent. It's inconsistent with the position of the agency.
That's a far different question to be inconsistent with Congress's intent.
Well, Congress
rarely
would not have
we had a case where everybody agreed on Congress's intent on anything.
Well, if FAGRMA and the Lanois Commission were all about preventing this rampant undercollection of royalties, about providing enforcement tools where there were none, Congress would not have simultaneously rendered meaningless strict time limits on a policy for appealing an order to perform. And that's what the IBLA has done here. That's why it's inconsistent with Congress. And the agency itself has now said that it disavows this decision. It's got
changing,
regulations
right?
pending.
It's not disavowing the decision. They're changing regulations.
They are clarifying.
Okay. Agencies that change regulations always say they're clarifying, I think.
Any more questions?
No.
All right, your time is up.
Already done.
Ms. Newman.
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, Jennifer Newman for the Department of the Interior. With me at Council's table is Nikki Kochakar with the Department and Craig Carver representing Merit. This case presents a straightforward question of whether deference is due to the agency's interpretation of ambiguous regulations. Hickorya would have this court overturn the board's interpretation of Parts 290 and 241. But there is nothing in any statute or regulation that compels that result.
But what about the argument that what the IBLA did here, in effect, was gut 290? That there was some value in the 290 jurisprudence or decision making that's now gone. That it makes no sense to have this strict enforcement of 290 just to be able to end run. And run to 241. That's a pretty strong argument, isn't it?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, for one thing, the part it's not as if the Part 290 appeals process has disappeared. Certainly, folks continue to use that process to appeal orders to perform whenever they get them.
But why would they not, if they didn't show up for 290, why don't they just show up for 241? What's the point then?
Well, there are some differences in the process, you know. There's a different
are they differences
decision.
That make it? Are there distinctions that make a difference? I mean, there
are
always differences in process, but
right. I mean, certainly there's a different decision maker in the right. intermediate phase of each of the two parts, the two appeals processes. But you know, some people just don't want to wait. They don't want to risk getting one step further down the road before they get a decision and have the potential to accrue more penalties, et cetera, et cetera.
Is there a good reason why Congress would create a two bites at the apple process here? Is there?
Well, Congress didn't really address this question at all, one way or the other. This is a procedural question about how the agency should be structuring its process. Yeah. And while Congress did say that there had to be a hearing on the record
right.
before civil penalties can be imposed, it didn't express an opinion on exactly yeah. what had to be included in that
help
process.
Me make sense of why there would be a 290 process and then another appeals process in 241. Help me to understand why that makes sense.
Well, it's largely, as the board explained, an artifact of the fact that the 290 process already exists whenever Congress enacted FAGRMA,
yeah.
and the agency had to come in and create a hearing on the record process for these penalty orders. And it's certainly not the typical situation where you have an agency creating essentially an optional appeals process. That's basically what the board has done. But it's also true that there's nothing in any statute or regulation that prevents the agency from doing that. And in that circumstance, I think that
turn it the other way. What is it in the statute that empowers it?
What is it?
I never like arguments to say, well, Congress didn't say we couldn't, therefore we can. That's
right.
Some element of non-secretary to it.
Right. I mean, you know, to the extent that Congress addressed this at all, it said that there should be a hearing on the record before the imposition of civil penalties. And if the department, in its balancing of its procedures and the different policy concerns that it's weighing, chooses to make an appeals process that's not a hearing on the record available for orders to perform, and then also allow it a lessee to opt to raise these issues in a 241 hearing on the record process, I think that that's up to the agency to decide.
So is that your argument? The agency created two processes, one not on the record, the other on the record.
And that's essentially what the board's decision does. I mean, it doesn't say that in so many words, but that's the outcome, is that there are essentially two processes. And
but the agency is now backtracking on that, right? They don't like that.
Well, they are certainly considering changing the rule. The current status of that is the comment period closed in September, and they have not yet finalized the rule, so we don't know what it's going to look like or if it will ever be finalized.
It certainly does seem to suggest some discomfort with the IBLA's decision, though, right?
Certainly by some in the agency, and certainly the MMS argued the opposite way in front of the IBLA. That's no secret in this case. But the regulations of the Secretary provide that the IBLA exercises the Secretary's authority in interpreting regulations, and so this is the Department's official position at this time.
That's a less than ringing endorsement, but I understand.
Thank you. And I want to go back to a point that you made earlier, Judge Griffith, which is really that, you know, the law here is clear that the Board's interpretation gets controlling weight unless HCRA can show that it is plainly erroneous or inconsistent with some language in the statute or regulation.
To repeat your opponent's argument, I think he says, well, that's what we have here because the 290 process is just rendered meaningless. And your answer to that is?
Well, as the court has explored, you know, the agency has not addressed that question before this case. And there is still something left of the 290 process. Again, lots of folks opt to do it because they want to get an answer quickly, right? They don't want to wait around for the agency to take yet another action and risk accruing more penalties, et cetera. And like I said, there's also a different intermediate decision maker. Ultimately, the appeals end up at the IBLA. But, again, there's nothing in any statute or regulation that prevents the board from doing what it did here. And so I think that its interpretation should be upheld.
Can I ask you 241.56, which is this provision we've been talking about all afternoon, the only two sentences seem to say the same thing. In other words, if you didn't request a hearing under 241.54, you can only challenge the penalty. They say it two different ways. All right, finish this sentence, if you would. If, however, you did request a hearing on the record under 241.54
for the notice of noncompliance, then you cannot challenge the.
No, I'm asking you
the
opposite.
The actual.
If you turn to the language, that would help.
Yes.
It says that two sentences say, as Judge Santel mentioned earlier, they both say, in the negative, if you didn't previously request a hearing under 241.54, you can only challenge the civil penalty. They say it two different ways. And my question is, if it went on to say, if, however, you did request a hearing on the record under 241.54, what?
Well, as the board has interpreted the regulations, they would say you can contest the amount of civil penalties and your underlying liability.
Thank you.
Yes. And Your Honor has hit on, you know, sort of the key crux of the ambiguity in the regulations. You've got this one provision that actually talks about when you can or cannot contest underlying liability, and the board said that seems to suggest you can contest it in a situation like the one that we have here. Unless the court has specific questions about the administrative finality argument or the trust argument, I think that we would rest on our briefs on those two issues. Thank you.
Does Mr. Grove have any time left? All right, why don't you take 1 minute?
Thank you, Your Honor. This court has also said that agency action is arbitrary and capricious if the agency entirely failed to consider an important aspect of the problem in rendering its decision. And that's the case here. IVLA failed to take into account numerous aspects that were problematic.
What do you say to the government's argument that, no, there actually is a difference between the two processes that makes sense? 290 is a short-form way of getting a quick answer. You know, if you want to have a hearing and do all that sort of stuff, you can go the 241 route.
I will note, Your Honor, that it's significant that out of 39 other oil and gas producers on the Jicarilla Reservation who received virtually identical orders to perform, only Merit pursued this route. I would contend that it concocted this solution as an effort to make lemonade out of lemons.
You're not answering the question, but perhaps you are answering the question. So.
Each of these other producers understood that there was no such process available. And even Merit
itself.
How do we
know that they had a defense?
Well,
appeal does not mean that you don't know or don't think there's an appellate process available. You may think either it's hopeless or it's not, the game's not worth the candle. You may have other reasons for not appealing besides not thinking there's a process available.
No, it's whether they had other reasons for not waiting for 241. Many of them appealed. Some lost their appeals. Some won their appeals. Mm-hmm. Some went ahead and paid. Some settled the case with the Jicarilla Apache Nation. All other 38 took the 290 approach, or settled or paid without appealing under 290. It was only when...
I'm not sure what that proves, however. I'm willing to believe that's a fact. I didn't go back and count, but I don't know why that leads to any conclusion in particular.
Well, it does.
It didn't go the other route. Doesn't mean that the other route doesn't exist. It just means that they, it could just mean that they chose not to go that way, for whatever reason.
It's anomalous, Your Honor, and it creates other complications that were not even acknowledged by the IBLA. For example, there would normally be a statement of reasons to start the process if you were appealing under 290. And challenging the underlying validity of that order. Hearing under 241 requires no such statement of reasons. There's a 33-month time limit for resolving an appeal under 290. If you take this route with 241, there is no 33-month time limit. The IBLA doesn't account for any of those inconsistencies in its opinion, and it appears that they may not have even been aware of some of those unintended consequences. And the most important is that it eviscerates 290. It's in the aftermath. You could just simply wait and see whether the MMS issues a notice of noncompliance. And if it does, then take the 241 route. So what's the point of 290? Why would anyone?
That just sounds to me as if you're restating what the board said rather than refuting what the board said. Yeah, they said you could take the second process. Judge below the district judge said, yeah, they're right. But they're not wrong. And that's not to refute him, so this is what they said.
With all those inconsistencies and no explanation of those inconsistencies in the IBLA's decision, I would contend that under numerous standards, the decision is not deserving of deference.
Okay. All right, thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.